Welcome back to our Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I'm Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for May 18th, 2026. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, first off, this week, I got a report from Qualys. It's titled CVE-2026-46333, Local Root Privilege Escalation and Credential Disclosure in the Linux Kernel Ptrace Path. So researchers disclosed a Linux kernel vulnerability, enabling local privilege escalation and credential disclosure through flaws in the kernel ptrace path handling. The issue impacts Linux systems where unprivileged local users can interact with vulnerable ptrace operations to gain elevated access or expose sensitive credential materials. The vulnerability is significant because ptrace is deeply tied to debugging, process inspection, tracing functionality, really kind of making exploitation blend into otherwise legitimate looking system activity. Successful exploitation can allow attackers to pivot from an initial low privilege foothold into full root compromise, increasing the operational impact of phishing, container escapes, use of stolen credentials, stealing of user credentials, and so on. The research highlights continued attacker interests that we've been seeing, especially very recently and as of late, in the Linux kernel internals and the process management subsystems. Really looking at that attack vector, and I think that's a point of the conversation we'll get to here too with this one, Scott. So some of the kind of tech pieces behind this, or the technical specs behind this, the flaw exists in that ptrace kernel space. Basically, it affects how process tracing and credential handling are validated during specific tracing operations. The exploit involves abusing ptrace interactions against privileged or sensitive processes to bypass those permission boundaries. Attack activity would likely involve unusual use of debugging or tracing utilities like GDB, strace, and ptrace-capable binaries, or maybe even custom tooling that interacts with the slash proc, slash the whatever the PID is, slash mem directories, and related, as well as related process inspection interfaces. Researchers noted potential credential disclosure impacts in addition to privilege esc, meaning memory scraping or process credential extraction behaviors may accompany these exploit attempts. So something else to consider. The likely observable artifacts really kind of include like a normal access to that slash proc pathway, suspicious process attach attempts, elevated use of the ptrace underscore attach, and I think I noted here short-lived privilege transition chains that kind of lead to the UID equals zero contexts. Exploitation is local only, meaning adversaries require an existing foothold or code execution on the target Linux host before they can trigger the vulnerability. And the workflows may also involve temporary payload staging in writable directories like temp or your dev slash SHM or any of the other user home paths, which were kind of where the landing space is or what we're typically seeing with some of those other Linux kernel vulnerabilities that have been shouted on. But yeah, I think I kind of already mentioned it, Scott. There's a few things to kind of chase down here. Linux tends to be pretty straightforward as far as like how it processes, but also does have some oddball ways of how its telemetry tells you that story. So from a hunting perspective, I mean, looking for the processes and the process interactions or the directory pathway interactions that we talked about, like the slash proc, you know, really looking at the down the chain of that directory to your slash mem slash status slash task and so on. That could be a good giveaway. Another one that I like out of this one that kind of falls in line with some of the other recent Linux kernel vulnerabilities we've been seeing, where you see this kind of correlation activity where like a custom binary is launched or executed in a standard user space, and then you immediately see like sudo or su interaction in the same space, you know, really tied to the same kind of session processes, the session IDs and such. That's a pretty straightforward call out with pretty much all the Linux vulnerabilities, but just a couple things I wanted to tag from a, hey, why does this matter and how can we look at it thing. But I'll take a breath now and see what your thoughts were, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a pretty big one just because, one, it's existed so long, it means it's coming out of its foothold in many Linux versions and things that go back. So I know they don't put a huge emphasis on, like, or they do mention that it is a local only affected thing, but, you know, if anyone's ever done like hack the box and all those types of challenges, usually the context of those is you end up getting user access somewhere and then you have to elevate to get like the root access, which is pretty common unless there's some like really obviously bad vulnerability that you can take advantage of to go straight to root privileges. So examples are people use a lot of Linux web infrastructure, hosting like Apache and things. And a lot of times when if that infrastructure gets, or that web application gets hit, it's usually in the context of that, whatever user is running the web app, which is sometimes default is, I don't know, like www or www root or whatever. I don't know. But it's not like root of the system. So they still would have to break out of that, but they still have, you know, access to it because of they maybe hit that target. So the local only isn't so much of a, like, let's not worry. I think it's still really important to address, just because it seems like if they were able to come up with even four examples of taking advantage of this vulnerability, it means it's probably pretty easy to actually build exploits for this. But the good news is they kind of give you some ideas about what's being targeted potentially or what's actually being utilized. And that's a great opportunity for one, like ptrace is an example, or when you're using strace and those types of tools, it's really easy to, like, if you have the logging already enabled in your environment, so you, assuming you have good visibility, to see, well, what is typical for these types of processes anyways. In a lot of cases, sometimes these one-off processes aren't heavily used unless there's some application that relies on them. So you're seeing mostly admins troubleshooting things and rare instances. So it makes it very easy to kind of pick up on things that may be of interest, right? Kind of, we always talk about, like, know what your environment looks like. Good example of being able to do that for something that could be really critical, but at least you can kind of keep an eye on things until things get patched from that perspective. So that's really kind of my two cents there, is just kind of like, how do you approach this necessarily? And you can do some proof of concepts and maybe see some, like, what does it look like specifically? But if you don't have that capability, I feel like just doing enough research, understanding what processes to pay attention to, maybe what targets are being targeted from a command line perspective, you might be able to pick up on activity that's worth basically pivoting into and investigating.
Yeah, good points. I think one last drop too, especially anybody that's novice or isn't spending or hasn't spent a lot of time in the Linux space. Audit is great for things like this because you can generally see a lot of the activity, a lot of the syscall activity, right? So if you can leverage Audit D in your environment for that enhanced telemetry, looking for things like those ptrace syscalls, you should be able to see, especially if you see them originating from standard user space and not root, you know, other good signals, just using that added telemetry. But yep. All right, what's next, Scott?
Yeah, so next one was just, I thought, a really insightful article. And I love when there's, one, like, kind of good repos for tooling, but two, when they're supported by, you know, big names, because that means, like, the tooling has a little more validation, more likely success to run. And what am I talking about? Well, Microsoft, being a big entity, they introduced two tools that really help with agent development, like AI agent development, as far as, like, how to validate that they're safe and also understanding the workflow of creating them. The tools are called Rampart and Clarity. Rampart is it's a red teaming type tool. It's built on top of Pyrit, Pyrit, which was optimized for, like, a black box discovery for security breachers after a system is built to, like, look for potential issues. So it kind of runs in that. But basically what it does is Rampart is a way for it to kind of run those generative AI attacks against your code base. So you can kind of see what potentially could be taken advantage of from that perspective. So it's kind of a cool way to kind of do like your own little mini pen test against any AI agents that you have built, or, you know, different stages of your build to test certain things of your agent. So kind of cool. We're all kind of familiar with, you know, different types of pen testing type tools or code / pen testing type tools, but Clarity is a really good tool because it is really designed to help before you start developing and while developing. So it's basically you can you work with it. It kind of has like the AI interaction piece to talk about what is your project, what are you trying to achieve. It helps you make decisions about, oh, this is what you should be thinking about, this is how you should build that, that kind of thing. So it really helps with that development process. So you can kind of have that clarity, right? That's why it's been named that way. Okay, here's my overall objective. And I want to build for these things. And it, through the cycle, so because a lot of times when you think about anyone, especially if it's not a lot of experience in dev or anything they've never really done before, you kind of like walk down the path, learn some things along the way, and wish you would have implemented certain things going, you know, previously when you started, right? But you might not have the time, the resources, and you don't want to start over, whatever it is. I think this is kind of cool because it lets you kind of get ahead of some of that. And so you kind of start with a better base, and then you can kind of use Rampart as your next safety net is, all right, I thought I planned it out really well, had a good idea, and now let's see if there's anything that's egregious that Rampart picks up as well. So I think these two tools together are really cool. Like I said, they're available today, open source projects maintained by Microsoft. So yeah, and with agentic AI stuff and like the fear of like, because I mean, if you build something wrong with agentic AI where it has access to potential files, do certain actions on systems, like whatever it is that you're trying to actually kind of automate with AI, there could be really big implications. So I do think using things like these is kind of like due diligence. It's something that should at least be looked at if you're doing this. As this validation that at least you've been doing it right, or maybe you can look at it and say this is a good tool or not a good tool, but because it exists, I think people should check it out. So yeah, I don't know, when you looked at this, kind of what'd you think?
I thought it was funny because it tied, it's almost like good timing, like the universe heard us ask the question, because I think it was last show we asked the question like what kind of things could we put in front of like the developer space and people building some of these packages that in the supply chain, or the AI, the agentic AI agents, or whatever the flash term is now. But no, I liked it. I think it's pretty cool. I was drawn more to the Clarity one just because of what it's trying to do and how it's trying to pose as like this, you know, experienced architect, experienced engineer to try to ask the questions you might not think about or might be higher tech and really kind of like drive the development cycle. I really kind of like that. I kind of want to dive more in them. Have you played with these yet, Scott, or just kind of came across them?
No, I just came across them too soon for me to really try to play with some of them, but they're now like on my radar. So if I start experimenting with anything, it'll probably be some of the first steps I do. Right.
Yeah, man, this is going on the list. This is great.
Yeah. So hopefully other people will find, you know, use of this, or even if you're just getting your feet wet and you don't really know much about agentic AI, you know, agent type stuff, it might be a good place to get started. So you, when you talk about it or learn about it, you're at least having better insights than some, just average person just picking up things and running with them.
Absolutely.
All right. What do you got for us next?
I have my, what I think might be mine, not that I'm claiming the fame to it, but a bit of a broken record topic here. So we're talking more supply chain attacks.
Woo. Yeah.
So there's a very recent article. It was either yesterday or today from Socket talking about the mini Shai-Hulud hits at AMPV ecosystem, 639 compromised NPM package versions. So multiple widely used JavaScript visualization packages that are associated with the AMPV ecosystem were compromised through malicious package updates published out to NPM. here we go again, right? The activity represents the supply chain style intrusion where trusted developer dependencies were weaponized to execute malicious code during installation or runtime. And the campaign primarily targeted developers in that CI/CD environments, really that automatically consume package updates without any strict version like pinning or integrity validation or things like that. The malicious packages attempted to establish persistence right away and retrieve additional payloads, creating a bit of that downstream risk for those development pipelines and even production applications. The incident highlights continued adversary focus on open source ecosystems, really kind of just stemming and tearing apart the supply chain snowball, if you will, or just the boulder that's rolling down the hill. So some of the tech pieces from this. Ultimately, at the end of it, it's there's some pretty simple things you can track that would keep you in line for this, and if you're trying to hunt for it in your environment. But the compromised ANTV-related NPM packages contained obfuscated JavaScript injected into the package files that they pulled from NPM. The malicious logic executed during package installation phases. So it was leveraging that thing I keep saying, that NPM lifecycle behaviors, where that post-install, pre-install type stuff. Are where you're getting a lot of the damage. The payload immediately attempted outbound network communications to the attacker-controlled infrastructure, primarily to pull down the second stage of the content. The behavioral patterns included execution of shell commands, specifically from node.js context, and the use of child process functionality to interact with the host operating system to kind of blend in as that normal activity, hide in the post and pre-install phases. The activity focused on developer workstations again, and it really targeted those automated build runners where you had the NPM, yarn, PNPM dependency installations that were needed. The attack flow aligned with common NPM compromised tradecraft, right? The account was, or one of the accounts or a package was compromised, leads to malicious package publication. And then that automated downstream dependency piece is just pulling across everything. Always scary. These should always be of concern, especially if you have pretty active developer environments. Some of the suspicious indicators you can kind of look at are, unexpected modifications to certain package scripts, right? Newly introduced post-install or pre-install logic, if you're able to get that granular, and heavily obfuscated JavaScript kind of partnering alongside legitimate libraries. One thing that is seen here, and this is the one that I keep shouting in these, Scott, I almost feel like it's a broken record. I do feel like we have to keep talking about the supply chain stuff. I think it's important because of the impact it can have. But we do tend to see pretty much similar things, which is, for us as defenders and hunters, it's good to have these things in our arsenal, right? So I feel like I say it all the time, but watching for node activity in your environment. Key number one, everybody's using it. It's being adopted everywhere. It's specifically and absolute in almost all of these supply chain attacks. So consider node, watching node, the processes, what it's kicking off, what it's interacting with. And then in this one specifically, we actually got to see that second layer again, where Node will actually pull down and execute and work its next set of payloads through bun runtime. So you'll see Node as the parent operating or activating bun, and then bun's doing its thing and its post install and pre-install pathways to execute that payload. So it just gets under the covers more. You can track those processes with the base telemetry in Linux. Definitely the thing that I harp on anytime I get to talk to people about this, because this helps it make it not so scary, in my opinion. It's something easy to do. It's easy check you can put out there. It's stuff that's not super talked about, even though it seems to be happening every time. And it's being this behavior, this technique of payload distribution is being adopted by people in many other areas targeting many other different things. So it's the thing I'm going to harp on for a little while until we see any change. But again, just another representation of this happening, it happening in similar ways that we've already talked about, but you're seeing the same behaviors that you can go hunt for to kind of keep you ahead of the game here. So I'll take a breath, Scott. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I thought it was interesting. Like, even when I was trying to dig through this, I was like, man, this was a really long article, but you realize that like most of it is just the giant list of packages they identified that were actually compromised in this way. But because I was hoping for even more technical detail about what basically occurred on these systems. They didn't really include a lot specific to like the runtime or execution of things, but they did include the pre-install with the bun run, like you talked about, and then the optional dependencies that can be listed as well. As far as the package, so that kind of lets you, if you think you've got a malicious package, sometimes it's good to look up those first few things that run for your pre-install optional dependencies, and then you can go to that location if you're going to do further investigation and kind of see what is it doing. So there's opportunities there. The other thing they seem to pick up on, other than things in the package, was network activity. So if you have good enough visibility to see different types of callouts to URLs and domains, maybe there is an opportunity for some outliers there. I've never really looked at the behavior to the sources. So what they basically did was list non-malicious common endpoints at https registry.npmjs.org and out fulcio with a C, fulcio.sixstore.dev. They were basically saying that it's not really common to have these endpoints hit unexpectedly. But when, you know, from basically if you get a new package and there's a lot of activity that's hitting these things, it could be where it's trying to enumerate things about the package, things about the user using the package, that kind of stuff. So it might be some opportunity there. I can't really vet or validate how obscure that behavior would be or not. But they call it out here. And Socket does seem to put a lot of attention to these types of compromises from a supply chain perspective. So I'm assuming that there's something to be said. They talk about some naming patterns. They talk about some of the targeting as far as what they're after inside some of these packages. But all in all, the point being I see is, one, it's still happening like it has been happening, so that part hasn't really changed too much. And from what we can tell from the execution, it's still kind of following some of the same craft. So it's almost like just kind of be on the up and up as far as what is currently going on when you look at these overall holistically. And the big thing is when more reporting comes out in the future, try to pick out what changes because it'll probably be a good thread to follow.
Yep. That's pretty much my stance right now. I'm actively watching these personally because I find it very interesting. Also, it's in our wheelhouse, right? And that we need to kind of be hip to it. One of the things I did not mention, you kind of touched on it there too, Scott. That's something else that I think should be echoed. So when we talk Node, we talk this kind of supply chain pathway. If you can see those network callouts, anything you're seeing, even as an unstructured hunt type of thing, just to know what's going on in your environment, seeing activity that goes with legitimate npmjs.org domain at all, especially the registry part, track it, especially right now. Understand what's happening in your environment, who's going there. I say that because this is just another representation, and we've had so many of them over the past few months, really for the course of this year already, where that behavior of leveraging Node generally will start, in a lot of cases, will start where the actor gets a foothold, and then they just go and pull a legitimate version of Node.js down. So you will see that activity. If you see it in a place that's just obscure or odd, you know, finding a way to get to that data, pulling your tops, how, you know, the look for the rarities, like who's only gone there so many times, like basic stuff like that can get you way ahead of the game here. And definitely consider that. Don't make those discardable, pathways for hunting this, because it is a legitimate, you know, site or whatnot. But bad actors are using those legitimate sites to help them get what they're trying to get done. So stay on the up and up with those if you can.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Yeah, I'm going to shift. This one is a blog from ESET, right? And it's basically touching on the webworm new burrowing techniques, right? And basically, if you're not familiar with webworm, it's the name that they call their China aligned threat group. And webworm's kind of been around since 2022, or has been tracked about that far back. But it's not just a new malware family, right, that's associated with it. It's actually a group, and they use different kind of tooling. But the thing they call out is some of their tradecraft has actually shifted. So it's always kind of interesting. And this is always another topic of a conversation, right? Do we change actor names if their craft changes, or do we keep the same name? People kind of split on that. My guess is they're keeping the same name, maybe because everything else about who they target, how they operate, their priorities maybe still aligned, but maybe their tradecraft's changed. But basically, their older way they used to operate was they used a lot of more recognizable rats. Now they move more towards living inside trusted internet services like Discord, GitHub, Amazon S3, Microsoft Graph, OneDrive. So one of the big takeaways is the webworm is using tools that blend into normal enterprise traffic. They have one backdoor, they call it Echo Creep, which actually uses Discord for its command and control. They have Graphworm, which uses Microsoft Graph and OneDrive to pass commands, and upload and download files, retrieve jobs. That means it's not as simple when you're like trying to defend, to hunt for your standard IOCs to try to nail some of these things down. So really what you have to look at is, should this service account or this executable really be talking to Discord or Graph API at all, right? So that's kind of how you have to kind of frame everything. It does also highlight they have a heavy use of proxy and tunneling tools that they use. A lot include open source, but they also have custom tools, Worm, FRP, Chainworm, Smux Proxy, WormSocket. That's where they'd be putting these tools in place that might create new listening ports or create unexpected socks or reverse proxy activity on systems that take over. Or, looking for weird binaries running from writable paths like program data, app data, or temp directories, which are commonly leveraged. So based on some of the activity, though, let's see, kind of pull through some of these. Got a lot of notes on things to potentially pay attention to, right? One is obviously if you're looking for Discord activity, and it's definitely you can't tie that network activity. And some tools will tie executables to certain network calls to Discord. It's a huge red flag. And especially if the foothold is on like say a jump box or something more on the edge, that's going to be a big red flag as well. If it's not even like a user based system. The other thing, they do use Go binaries to launch some of their stuff, or it's written in some of their stuff, but they're also dropping those in those temp directories, like I mentioned. So that's the public program data, temp app data type stuff, paying attention to those. The Graphworm, when I mentioned, it uses Microsoft Graph API and OneDrive folder. It basically creates a OneDrive folder where it can drop things in, and leverage those. So you got specific non-standard processes contacting graph.microsoft.com, SharePoint.com, OneDrive, Live.com, those types of things worth paying attention to. And then they did, for persistence, set up scheduled tasks, Echo Creep of the Discord version. That was one of the ways it stayed persistent. It named itself Microsoft SSH Update. Kind of funny to throw all those things in there together. It almost makes it suspicious to me, but that's something else to kind of pay attention to. And then not only that, but when you're looking for these specific fields, there wasn't a lot of, based on the tooling they use, command execution capabilities. So they did rely, or seem like they still rely heavily on command terminal and PowerShell to then launch other things. So when you have weird parents of command prompt and PowerShell, worth paying attention to. But also look for the weird things in the additional fields if you're looking at scheduled tasks updated or task created type events. If you see command prompt in there or PowerShell, or you can use a specific name, right? based on the names they use to look for things. But that's usually a lot of really credible stuff when you look at that specific stuff. Also, something else that I think is interesting, you know, there are a lot of tools they use for proxying, and there's also, you know, soft tools from open source they use. Like they use soft EtherVPN as an example, is something that is part of their tool set. But if something runs as a proxy, it is very common that there will be command line arguments provided. And a lot of times those command line arguments will contain like SOX 5 or proxy in the name, or TCP or bind or connect. You might be able to kind of group some of these, you know, words together, and it might be noisy, right? So you might have to kind of see what looks normal, what doesn't in your environment. Might have to kind of distill some things down or deal with some false positives. But if you don't know the right answer, sometimes that approach is good enough, at least until you kind of get a better approach or get a grip on things. So something to kind of consider. Let's see. Oh, yeah. For anything that's going to call out to GitHub or S3, because Worm FRP, it basically, they were able to compromise different GitHub repos and S3 buckets. They're owned by somebody else, so they're legitimate. But they put their kind of C2 or their stuff in those locations, and we're calling it with the Worm FRP. So when you have processes that are reaching out to either S3 or GitHub, like curl or wget or PowerShell, cert util, bitsadmin, you know, there's a few you can list there. That's also a good indication that that's probably not normal or worth looking into. GitHub might be a little more normal, I would say, but S3 bucket, maybe less. So worth paying attention to those things. They did mention that they do believe that Squirrel Mail, well, they had an exploit that they think was being leveraged to get some access. So if you're able to have WAF or proxy logs, you can kind of look for a high rate of URI enumeration. That means something's being scanned across that way. They also use Nuclei as another scanner. So there's a specific user agent associated with that that you could look for the potential, the reconning activity. Oftentimes you'll probably find recon anyways, so it'd be really hard to do attribution. But it is something that's going to be in the data that you potentially could see. I mentioned that they're using PowerShell and command prompt via whatever executable they're using. So just pay attention to those things. They called that out twice, I think. And those are kind of the key things. Oh, they did use a registry run key, if I remember. I forgot which malware specific, but there was a registry run key instance. So your typical lines of persistent exist there. I think one of the key persistences, they can find that foothold and use some of their proxying / tunneling capabilities. That's probably all they really keep live, and they just kind of work through that. But yeah, so just kind of a attack that's kind of changed some of his craft, and it seems like it's leveraging kind of the common things we see in general anyways that, you know, industry is moving towards and other attackers are using as well. So yeah, I don't know if anything stood out to you, Tom. That's all I got.
Big article, lots of stuff.
Yeah,
and you covered on pretty much most of it. Now, the register run clean run key was associated with Graphform, with that part of it. And then the other thing I thought, I don't, maybe you mentioned this and I just didn't hear it clearly, but one of the other things I thought might be interesting is tracking that kind of graph API, the graph use or the graph communications. To be completely honest, I'm not sure what that looks like. Maybe you have a better idea, but it interacting and exfiltrating and pulling and loading and staging from graph to OneDrive seemed interesting to me, especially since it was using valid cloud accounts based on the whole process. That basically one of the nuggets inside the whole thing is that it would actively have a valid account to leverage. So maybe there's something there that can be used, you know, as far as something for anomalous stuff.
I'm trying to see if I could find it real quick, but there was one API-ish call with the graph that is meant to move a lot of data. I'm trying to find the exact word as part of that. It's got the, create upload session, I believe. And by doing that, it enables basically the ability to move a lot of data in one direction because you're creating a whole session, not just like, you know, temporary type thing. So that's something if you, and usually you'll see the API calls as part of the URI. Sometimes I think it's attached at the end of all the stuff with the graph.microsoft. You'll see it kind of towards the tail end. That's worth noting just because, you know, a lot of data is moving. And that's kind of how the mechanism they were using to move. So something else to kind of pay attention to. When you look at graph, there's calls you can see within graph that might be of interest or more interest to you as well.
Yeah, I always take that kind of like look at when we look at reports and intel and stuff like this, where we're looking at potential opportunities, where it's like, okay, well, graph's talking to one drive. Well, maybe that's normal. Maybe that's normal in your environment. But do you know, right? Because these kinds of things can help you ask questions to drive you to that know my environment in a way I didn't think about it before, which I really like. So just the last little tidbit there.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I think that kind of wraps up everything that we were going to cover. So I really hope everyone enjoyed or maybe walked away with something from what we talked about today. I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast and looking forward to syncing back up next time. So with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of May 18th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.